There are good reasons for bad feelings, good reasons for them to exist at all, which does not mean they're always useful. What evolutionary psychiatry really offers, what it offers is a framework for making sense out of everything without having to lock yourself into believing that everything comes from genes or everything comes from childhood abuse or everything comes from thinking wrong about things or everything comes from bad experiences that you've learned, bad habits. It's a framework for putting it all together. And more psychiatrists and psychotherapists are, I think, recognizing that they really want a framework that allows them to be, you know, a complete therapist who's considering all possible causes and all possible treatments.
The capacity for low mood exists because it's useful in certain situations. And the situations in which it's useful, most generically, are situations where you're spending a lot of effort to do something that isn't working. And this is a question I've heard you note, a crucial question about emotion, which is, quote, in what situation was this emotion useful across our evolutionary history? And I would love to start the conversation there and get your opinion and your viewpoint on those couple of ideas and have you speak at whatever length you would like about the field you're an expert in, which is evolutionary psychiatry, and take the conversation from there.
So Dan, you picked out the one right at the center of everything. I mean, why on earth do we have this capacity for depression? And the psychiatry residents that I trained over decades come back and tell me, hey, Randy, the thing that I've learned from you that was the most important of all is to ask patients about, are you trying to do something that's just so important you can't possibly give it up, but you think you're never going to succeed? Now, I didn't start even thinking about evolution and depression until I'd spent 15 years treating people with anxiety disorders full time at the University of Michigan. And it's pretty easy to see how anxiety can be useful. And I finally started thinking about, well, how could low mood possibly be useful? And just for clarity, I try to keep low mood separate from depression, because these days people hear the word depression and they think brain disease, drugs, that kind of thing. So low mood is depression that might be bad or might not be bad and might be useful, might not be. It's kind of a more generic term. And my biggest insight of my whole career, Dan, is trying to understand why emotions exist. And a lot of evolution types have talked about them serving functions or being modules. And I think that's not really an evolutionary view. What they do is they adjust everything in us to cope with a certain kind of situation that's occurred over and over again over evolutionary history and influenced our fitness, that is, how long we live and how many children we have. So putting it in that context, asking myself, are there situations in which low mood, being kind of not interested in doing things and low energy and all of feeling bad about yourself, are there situations in which that might be useful? And once I took that approach to the problem, I started reading other people, especially Eric Klinger, who wrote about this brilliantly back in the 80s. And he pointed out that there's a whole system built into us to adjust where we put our effort. And if we're trying to do something that just isn't working, that system, first of all, makes us kind of pessimistic and sleep a little more. And if that doesn't work, it shifts us to try a different strategy. And if that doesn't work, we pull back more and put less energy into it. And if that doesn't work, we try to block everything. That is, we lose all interest in everything. And that's real depression. And even back then, he recognized that if you continue pursuing a goal that you're not making any progress for, even though the system is telling you this isn't working, then ordinary low mood escalates into depression. And once I started realizing that, I started asking my patients different things. Instead of, you know, are you under stress? Have you had bad life events? I started asking them, what are you trying to do in life? How are things going? And it just opened up a whole new world that I hadn't seen before.
Absolutely mind-blowing. And this dovetails into another quote I wrote down from you, which is, quote, I think I've cured more people by helping them to give up useless goals than I have helping them pursue goals. And I'd love to give a little bit of time to, if you're open to it, fleshing out some of the stories you remember from, you know, you're a medical doctor, and I know you have seen patients in your careers. What is salient there? What kind of pursuits have you seen that are not working that you know, in your practice, you would sort of chalk up to causing depression in people that you've met over the course of your career?
Really good question, Dan. But we have to be careful about this one, because when I first started talking about evolution and mood, a number of radio broadcasters would have me on and say, "And so, Dr. Ness, you think we should just give up on things?" And the answer is no.
Yeah.
What we all should do is be more sympathetic towards our patients and ourselves, because we're all constantly in situations where things are not succeeding all that well. And we have to make very difficult decisions about whether to continue to put effort in, to keep trying or wait or something, or whether to stop. And stopping quickly is never smart. I think that's one of the main reasons why depression is so common, because we invest years and our dreams and hopes and jobs and marriages and personal pursuits and the like. And when they're not going well, it's dumb to just give them up, you know? That's not smart at all. So we persist in doing things even when they're not going well. And that's a good thing until it isn't. But as a psychotherapist and as a psychiatrist, I found that this perspective allowed me to get into things deeper with patients about, oh, gosh, you know, as you mentioned your marriage, it sounds like you really are very dissatisfied, but you also see very good reasons not to leave. Can we talk about that? So instead of saying, you know, give up or stick it out, you start listening to people more deeply and you try to figure out, you know, what's going on with this person now, and you sympathize with them, and it's never simple. If it was simple, people would have solved it themselves.
That tipping point that you just alluded to, where it's, you know, determination and persistence is good until it's not, and obviously this is a very complex, probably person-to-person strategic approach, but in your mind, what are the frameworks you think through or think are wise to have as just a person to kind of be able to discern the difference between a problem or a relationship, an initiative you've started that needs some endurance versus one that really maybe should be given up entirely?
Yeah, you mentioned before about, you know, the things we do are sometimes large. I mean, if you want to break into rock and roll, you can't give up after the first year, you know? And if you want to become a leading podcaster, even if the first few don't go well or something, you need to stick it out and keep going. And almost everyone experiences frustration and near failure. I mean, how many businesses fail? I mean, 2/3 of small businesses fail. What a wrenching problem for someone who's devoted their life and their cash to starting a business and the like. And then there's marriages, a deeper investment. And, you know, New York Times kept running an article over and over again a couple of years ago about why you'll be dissatisfied with your marriage. I thought that was kind of mean, you know, to just point that out. On the other hand, you know, romantic love makes everything seem wonderful, as if, you know, everything's going to be perfect forever, and it never is. And most people gradually adapt and become very satisfied with what they have, but other people don't. You know, you can't, these generalizations don't, one thing, Dan, that's really, people imagine that evolutionary psychiatry is somehow crude and simple and biological, and it gives simple advice, stay in your marriage, leave your marriage. No, what it says is we really must understand people one person at a time, and not in half an hour with a questionnaire. I mean, it takes real discussion. And it shouldn't be done crudely either, because, you know, blundering in is, I was in the emergency room one night. And I was a junior guy, and the senior person, who wasn't much older, and you'll be able to tell that in just a minute, we had somebody come in, and he said, you know what, I'm really feeling bad because my wife won't have sex with me, and I don't know what I should do. And the senior psychiatrist, he was a senior resident only, who was supposed to be teaching me the job, and he said, well, there's only three things you can do. You can get her to have sex with you, or you can give up on that, or you can divorce her. You just have to decide. I thought, my God, I don't want to be like that. You know, let's say, of course, in the emergency room, it's a whole different scene. You know, that's not a good place to go to talk about whether you should, you know, stay in your marriage or not. But another angle on this has been recent, Jan, for me is to do a connection with ambition. You know, back to the Puritans and in every philosophy, people warn about ambition. And, you know, all organizations seem to push. I mean, if you go to Stanford, the welcoming class is told, you're all going to be great. Mm. You just need to, you know, I mean, and you know, it doesn't matter where you are. Groups tend to push people to accomplish everything they possibly can, which is wonderful. I mean, it's so fabulous that people do things. But I do wonder that our whole society now is pushing and expecting everybody to be super and great and stupendous about everything. And, you know, that's not really possible. And if you've seen enough very rich or very famous people, as I've had the fortune to, you realize that, no, it's not that great, actually. Yeah. That doesn't make you happier, really. So this whole business of everybody feeling like they have to have, you know, at least as many viewers as Mr. Beast, you know, on YouTube or something like that. I think it's a trap. On the other hand, as soon as I say that, I realize that, you know, the people who accomplish great things and the people who become very satisfied with what they're doing, they keep persisting in the face of things not always going well. Mm.
I think I heard you say once that there was a quote you love from a prep school you had gone to about ambition, that you want to be ambitious, but not too much, something like that.
You have read it carefully. My goodness, Dan. Yeah. I used to ride my bike past that place and it said, aim high, but not too high. Mm. And I thought, oh, I bet they've erased it by now, though. That is not a new millennium kind of thing. Mm. That's a 1980s, 70s kind of thing. Hmm.
I would love to go back, if you're open to it, to you know, evolution and the way you think about emotion in general, and just to revisit the key question: in what situations was this emotion useful across our evolutionary history? You mentioned this earlier about anxiety, and that a lot of people, I think, can get a pretty clear understanding as to why anxiety may have been useful for human beings in the past. There's the smoke detector principle, which I know you're famous for popularizing, but I'd love to give you some space to add a little bit more color as to why, you know, psychological disorders are still around, given that one might assume evolution would have eliminated that from human beings, from human nature, because of how destabilizing they are to us oftentimes. I'd love to put that to you and give you as much time as you'd like to flesh out your current thinking on that.
Lots of questions you raised there, Dan, and all good ones. You know, one place I'd like to go to in a few minutes is talking about how perfectly normal brain and psychological mechanisms give rise to a whole lot of useless anxiety and useless low mood. So I think there's a widespread assumption that if you're feeling useless anxiety or you lose this low mood, there must be something wrong with you. But actually, that's how the systems are designed. But let's come back to that after a few minutes. Mm. Let's instead talk about anxiety and how it's useful. That's, you know, I spent 10 years helping to develop one of the world's first anxiety disorders clinics at the University of Michigan. My mentor was George Curtis. He was the guy who really got it started. And, you know, after 10 years, I realized, why the heck are so many people anxious? And it's not that it's just them, it's me, it's everybody. Mm. Why do we have this capacity in the first place? I was strongly influenced by spending time with basic behavioral biologists who studied animal behavior. When I went and talked with them, they said, well, of course, every psychiatrist has to learn evolutionary biology and animal behavior, right? And I said, well, not exactly. Mm. You know, we don't know anything about it. It's a whole separate kind of science. But they pointed out that you need to ask why traits exist in the first place and how they influence your survival and reproduction. So I started thinking more deeply about, so why does anxiety exist? And then this new framework in my big 1990 article on emotions, I pointed out that, you know, in what situation is anxiety useful? When you're facing with a threat, when there's something that you might lose, whether it's, you know, an arm or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or money or status or whatever, if you're in a situation where you might lose something, you probably should pause and consider ways of avoiding losing it and decide what to do. And this brings us almost back to Freud, who pointed out that anxiety is useful to keep you from doing outrageous things that will make everybody not like you anymore. So that he talked about it on an unconscious level, which also exists. But plain old conscious anxiety also often stops us from doing things that would get us in trouble. It's more of a stopping, pursuing short-term pleasures and goals instead, and shifts us more towards longer-term thinking, which is good. But now we ask this big question, Dan, about why do we all seem to have too much anxiety? And you mentioned the smoke detector principle, so I'll go into that very briefly. I actually started trying to do the math about it, saying I was seeing patients with panic disorder all the time, you know, many each day. And for people who don't know about panic disorder, you suddenly all of a sudden out of the blue think, oh, my God, I feel like I'm going to die. My heart is pounding. I'm sweating. I feel like I got to get out of this room. I have a feeling of doom. Is it a heart attack? Is it a stroke? What's happening to me? And a lot of patients who have that go to the emergency room and they get checked out. And the well-meaning doctor says, you know, I can't find anything, but if it happens again, come back really fast. That's like the perfect recipe for creating a bad panic disorder from a panic attack, because then the person starts going about their business and then their heart starts beating a little bit. Uh-oh, is it happening again? And you get into a positive feedback cycle, which is so common for many mental disorders. This is a whole different level of causation than genes and cells and neurochemistry and even psychodynamics. It's just a plain old positive feedback thing. You experience your heart pounding a little bit. You think to yourself, oh, my gosh, maybe I'm having a heart attack, or maybe it's another panic attack. And of course, that fear makes your heart race more. And that makes you more anxious, makes the heart race more. And before you know it, in a few seconds, you're into a full-blown panic attack. And then most people tend to leave that situation, wherever they are, if it's a grocery store or a crowded place or an open place. And once you leave that situation, the anxiety goes down. And that makes your inner mind think, wow, I really missed something. Thank goodness I got out of there. And then you start avoiding. And once you start avoiding things, you know, it all gets worse. But the smoke detector principle helped me understand why these systems, that's the positive feedback cycle, but why do people have these things? I mean, there aren't any lines in grocery stores, right? So why do so many people have panic attacks in grocery stores? And I started doing the calculations. Think, well, how much, what's the cost of having a panic attack? And, you know, it's about 20 minutes and 100 calories. What's the cost of not having a panic attack? Well, if you're in a safe environment, there's no cost. It's great. What if you're in Africa with a stick, not even a proper spear, and you're at a watering hole trying to get water for your family, and you hear a little noise behind a rock? Should you run, climb a tree, or should you stay there and get water? And again, it depends. And we already know that it costs about 100 calories to run away. So what's the cost if you don't run away? And we're just going to pretend that that's 100,000 calories. And you can put those numbers into something called signal detection theory, first proposed by Swetson Green in 1966, University of Michigan colleagues from way back when. And the ratio is 1,000 to 1. And this means that the optimum amount of noise from behind that rock at which you start to flee is anything that indicates there's a probability of a lion there greater than 1 in 1,000. I did that calculation, Dan. I thought, this has got to be wrong. This is crazy. No. So I did it again and again. And I started thinking it. Then I started realizing, no, that's right. It is one. And this means that 999 panic attacks out of 1,000 are going to turn out to be unnecessary. Even though they're perfectly normal and on the average useful. So that led to calling it the smoke detector principle, because we all put up with smoke detectors that go off when there's burned toast, because we want to absolutely sure that the smoke detector goes off when there's a real fire, because that's a much more serious thing. So that's a long way of going about to begin. That's one of the explanations for why a lot of these negative emotions that come from perfectly normal mechanisms are actually useless. But there are other reasons why they can be normal but useless. We're in modern environments where there are different dangers we don't have enough fear of, guns and drugs, and then there are things that we continue to be afraid of, you know, spiders and snakes and the like, that, you know, aren't much of a danger. It's so fascinating to know. Again, the first 10 years I practiced seeing patients with anxiety disorders, I didn't have a theoretical framework, except to try to ask, you know, is it genes? Is it early life? Is it conditioning? Is it psychodynamics? But once I started having a real understanding, I felt like I was becoming a real doctor, you know, trying to understand how the normal system worked and how it was going wrong. And before I let you get in, I'm curious about your take to all of this, Dan, but I want to emphasize here that I'm not saying by any means that all of these, you know, abnormal emotion, all of these bad feelings come from normal mechanisms. I saw lots of people who had panic attacks, just like their sister, just like their mother, just like their grandmother. And, you know, it's highly heritable. It's influenced by what genes you have. The mechanisms can be broken that regulate the expression of these emotions, especially for depression. Often runs strongly in families, and sometimes it's influenced by drugs or inflammation or other kinds of things. So broad generalizations about saying that these emotions are useful in general, it's a mistake. You really have to investigate with each individual for them, you know, what situation are they in? Is the emotion that they're experiencing normal and useful, or normal and useless, or a product of a mechanism that isn't working? Or, and the most common one, is that people have a tendency to more anxiety or depression than other people, and they're in some kind of a situation that sets it off some, and then they get into some kind of positive feedback cycle that maintains it. I wish I could say something simple, you know, some simple generalization, but the generalization is that all generalizations are false.
I would love to get your story as to how, you know, I think you just said this, that it took you 10 years or so of being a practitioner before you had a new framework for becoming a real doctor, I think is how you assess yourself. And you open up your book with the story of a woman who came to visit you at the University of Michigan, I think it was, who had been to multiple other doctors, I think with primarily anxiety, and she got different assessments from three or four different doctors. And she walked out of your appointment with you, and she said a line that you write always stuck with you, which is something like, "Doctor, your profession is wildly confused." And I don't know if that dovetails into the shift in framework that you alluded to, that you came about, you know, having 10 years into your practice, but I'd love to put that to you and get the story as to how you shifted your lens in how you think about negative emotion, low mood, psychological ailments that people have, and how you were able to develop what you think is a more accurate way of thinking about the suffering that people are going through in those experiences.
So I'm glad you brought up that anecdote, because that woman's comment really did influence me. Maybe many people know what we psychiatrists call doorknob comments. And sometimes people will, you know, wait until they're actually touching the doorknob on their way out the door, and then they'll say the most profound thing of all. We need to be cautious here too, though, because, you know, she was disappointed in the whole idea of psychiatrists and psychotherapists in general, because she had tried her minister, she tried a cognitive behavioral therapist, she tried a psychoanalyst, she tried somebody. You just give her drugs and told her to come back in a month. And she was understandably frustrated because she felt like nobody was exactly listening to her. And she felt like, you know, they hadn't helped her. And so we tried very hard to listen to her, you know, and tried to sympathize with the difficulty of finding a kind of treatment that would work. And we didn't promise her she'd get all better, but we did tell her that we'd stick with her and try different things until we did find something that worked. I think that made her feel confident enough to say, as she went out the door, "You know, Dr. Nessie, that your profession is really confused, don't you?" And, you know, I think all thoughtful people who treat others who have mental disorders feel frustration that it can't be simpler. And there's a lot of anti-psychiatry stuff out there where people are saying there aren't such things as mental disorders. I mean, Lord help us. You go on Twitter, there's a bunch of people who say, "Oh, they're not real disorders and we should, you know, never go to psychiatrists." And it's such a crude generalization. You know, a lot of these are normal emotions, and a lot of them are tragic, serious illnesses, even anxiety and depression, but especially schizophrenia and obsessive compulsive disorders. And some are caused by real brain abnormalities too. We can't find the specific abnormalities. So I'm afraid I'm again saying it's complicated. But the thing for me was not just that woman's comment. It was that I got myself over to talk with basic scientists, not neuroscientists. They're useful and important. It's crucial we keep looking for neural causes for these disorders. But I got myself to talk with scientists who study behavior in animals. And they pointed out that every animal behavior textbook now is based on evolutionary biology. And it asks two different questions. One, how does it work? How does behavior work? How does the brain work? How does it regulate behavior? But to ask another kind of question is, how did the brain get that way? I mean, why is it that gull chicks peck at the little orange spot on their parents' beak? Why is it that rodents, you know, grow longer fur in the summer? It's because fall is coming. They don't know that, but the whole system is programmed like that. Why do rats, when they don't have access to regular food, gain weight by eating more? Well, it's because the signal means that the food supply is erratic, and it's wise to gain some extra weight if you are in the midst of a famine. So once I got their perspective and realized there was this whole other way of trying to understand these disorders, I started digging in. I wrote my first article in 1984. And instantly I realized that everybody was going to think this was bizarre, that nobody would pay any attention. And for my own sake, I started asking these other questions about why is there breast cancer? Why is there heart disease? Why is there obesity? Why didn't natural selection do a better job of designing us? And so this led to, you know, ever since then, I've led the charge and tried to organize people to try to grow the field of evolutionary medicine in general. That would never have been possible except for my collaboration with George Williams. I never knew he was a world famous evolutionary biologist when I started working with him, but he was very patient with me and we developed a great collaboration, wrote an article in 1991 and a book called Why We Get Sick that has a lot of this in it. And many people credit that book with spurring a lot of new interest in evolution and medicine. And now what is a very fast growing field, our International Society for Evolution Medicine and Public Health is 10 years old and has annual meetings in a beautiful place each year. Anybody who's listening to this who's interested should go there and join us. It's a wonderful group. But I'm finally coming back to psychiatry, and the field of evolutionary psychiatry is also growing fast, especially thanks to the efforts of some people in the UK, Riata Bedd and Paul St. John Smith. They've created a group as a part of the Royal College of Psychiatry. And so we're all working hard to try to educate people about, and not, I mean, it's hard to do it with patients in the general public, like we're doing here right now. And it's plenty hard already to do it with, you know, professionals who have PhDs and MDs and a deep background in biology, because even they really don't know enough about evolutionary biology to apply it until you get past some misconceptions and the like. So it's going to be a long road, but it's really thrilling to see that this whole missing perspective is being brought to bear, both on medical illnesses and on psychiatric problems.
I want to go back to your comments from earlier about depression. And I mean, my takeaway from what you mentioned about depression earlier is that it's often a corrective mechanism that is part of the human mind, the human psyche. And if there aren't firm heuristics or rules of thumb that you have for, you know, your patients or people in general that you would advise that, you know, perhaps at a certain point it's worth moving on from a goal that you have and that maybe the depression would disappear at that time. I'd love to, if there are individual cases that come to mind of people that had a fairly serious bout of depression or a crippling depression that once that you think really was the result of banging their head against the wall, trying to make something work that wasn't working in their life. If anything comes to mind in that department, I'd love for the audience just to give them more of a concrete example or a couple of examples that may come to mind for you where that may have been true.
Right. And at this point, I'd like to note that I think it's terribly important that patients who come to a therapist not get worried that their story is going to get told on a podcast.
Yeah.
So I never use in my book or in my talks any case that's exactly accurate. Or so they're all disguised one way or another, so that the person themselves would not recognize themselves. I think that's so important. You do read books where people, you know, give case descriptions where you could tell who the person is. I think that's just a terrible problem. But here's one person who came to me who is a very fairly successful accountant, and he had a good practice and the like. And then but when he came to me, he was very depressed, and he said, "I shouldn't be depressed." We went through, I mean, he was really depressed. He wasn't eating properly. He was losing weight. He was worrying all night. He was waking up early, all the traditional symptoms. And he said, "But I shouldn't be depressed." I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Because I just got a huge promotion and I doubled my salary." I said, "Well, that's interesting. What happened?" He said, "Well, this other company decided to set me up as their local office, and they gave me the whole floor of a building, and they gave me permission to hire 12 other lawyers and 20 staff, and I've been in the midst of that, and I just can't do it because I feel too depressed to do it." So as I said before, this is the kind of situation in which you don't just say quit or keep at it. You talk with the person. And it turned out that this person previously had been in an office with two or three other lawyers and a bunch of staff who loved him and supported him and said everything he did, they said it was great. And he had lots of business. This new one, it was a startup, basically. And the business could have failed, and there was he was hiring people who turned out to be grumpy, and it was hard to hire people, and it was not what he expected at all. And he wondered if he could ever succeed. And this is one where a long conversation and also, by the way, I gave him antidepressants, which were crucial, because in his case, the depression was not useful. It was keeping him from doing things he needed to do to see if this new organization could be launched. And sure enough, he got rid of some of his depression symptoms, and he was more successful in hiring people he needed to hire, and he felt more confident to get things done, and he did. And I saw him through his depression and saw him at a concert, actually, a few years later. And he was very thankful and very successful and very, very wealthy, because his salary really had doubled thanks to taking on this large challenge. So that's one that came out because of a person, succeeding at something. But then there are people who, are other kinds of situations. Here's one where I didn't succeed and the patient didn't either. Someone who was very artistically inclined, and it's quite successful in a community of note. There are certain neighborhoods that are artsy neighborhoods where everybody gets together and they get to know each other. And her problem was that her husband was having an affair, and he would go downstairs every evening and talk to his lover on the phone and pretend like that wasn't happening, but she knew perfectly well what was happening. And she was in this dilemma. Should I leave him? In which case I'd have to get a job and wouldn't be able to do my art, and we'd have to move to someplace else? Or should I stay with him and be humiliated and angry all the time and not have my own partner? In this exact situation is so common. This should be a DSM diagnosis, right? This should be, partners having an affair, can't leave, can't stay. It's really awful. That's a DSM diagnosis, or should be. But you don't just give glib advice about it, because it's a terrible problem, and there's always two people in the marriage too. So it's not as simple as there being one jerk. It's complicated. So off we go to figure out that case. I worked with her for a couple of years talking about options and trying to help. And she ended up, continuing. I think she was somewhat less depressed as a result of our treatment. She coped better with her situation, but she stayed in that bad situation. A more optimistic one is somebody who came, who had a child who was, the background for this woman is, I talked with her for an hour and I couldn't figure out why she was depressed. She was very depressed. Had a pretty good job, doing it was cleaning work she did, very close with her church and her family, had divorced her husband years ago. That wasn't an issue. She was old enough. She didn't want to find another man. And I kept trying to figure out what had changed. And finally, I kept asking, you know, systematically my questions, and I go through every different area of life and try to figure out, how are things going with your job? Fine. How are things going with your church? Fine. How about your family? Fine. And your kids? And then she got very quiet for a moment. And I said, well, what's going on? And she said, well, when I was a teenager, I got in with some bad people and I started dealing drugs, and my boyfriend mistreated me, actually beat me up a lot. And I vowed that whatever I did, once I got out of that, it would not happen to my daughter. I raised her that way, and I told her that. And as soon as she got out of high school, she moved in with a dealer. And I've been calling her ever since, several times a day, trying to help her get out of there, and she won't answer the phone. Well, isn't that a terrible situation? Mm. You can't just tell somebody stop, you know. So what do you do? And in this case, we started talking to her and said, gosh, what a terrible, terrible thing. And you are trying, but is what you're doing working? Is it helping her? And that's real cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, try to reframe what a person's experiencing. And she had to think about that for a long time. I can't give up, she said. And I said, well, no, we're not asking you about, is it helping? And she said, well, no. And is it maybe hurting? Because your daughter has never answered her phone. And she said, well, yeah. And she cried a lot. I mean, this is not an easy thing to talk about. But eventually, she recognized that those huge efforts of hers were not helping her daughter, and they were hurting her. And she had a lot of other efforts she could use to help other young women who weren't her daughter, who were in similar kinds of situations. And that one came out very well.
A reframe, right? And a new strategy for her, it sounds like.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I have heard you in other interviews talk about Freud in both, you know, I think you were alluding to in that conversation that Freud is not often viewed favorably in the world or the social circles you operate in. I've had Jim Hollis on my show a couple of times, a Jungian writer and psychoanalyst as well. And one of the lines from our first conversation I've always remembered and that has stuck with me when he was talking about clients that had come to see him who were depressed. And one of the first questions he would always ask them is, why has this come? And begin a conversation to try to get at maybe a deeper understanding as to why this has occurred in the individual that he was speaking with. And I don't know that I've ever heard you speak about Jung's ideas and Jung in general. I'd love to get you to have, you know, to share any feedback or comments you may have on that. And then also for the listeners who may not know the technical definition of what depression really is. I remember Jim saying that, you know, one of the definitions of depression is to push down. But I'd love to put that to you as well, just so that people who are listening and watching this can have a clear understanding of what you mean when you talk about depression in general.
So let's get that out of the way first. As you'll recall, early in the conversation, I talked about the difference between low mood and depression, and emphasized that actually they're kind of the same. Low mood generally being, you know, milder, but low mood doesn't imply that it's automatically an abnormal state, and depression for most people does imply that it's an abnormal state. There are lots of attempts to define exactly what it is and how many symptoms out of 9 and how long you have to have them and all the rest. And several of my previous students have gone on to do marvelous research showing that that too is too simple. Eiko Fried in particular has done marvelous research showing that the symptoms in the DSM, you know, such things as waking too early and, you know, lacking appetite and feeling hopeless and the like, those are no more central to depression than a lot of other symptoms. He's done fabulous mathematical modeling and network analysis of all these symptoms. So it is important for people to recognize that they might have depression and go get treatment, because treatment can be very effective. If a person is, you know, feeling like killing themselves or feeling hopeless and not eating and like, and sometimes depression gets so bad, people literally do not get out of bed and eat or anything. So then, that's not just a normal response, you know, no matter what's going on in the person's life. So that's depression. And again, notice I didn't give you a really crisp definition, because the reality from an evolutionary point of view is not only that it's got a lot of blurry boundaries, but another student of mine, Matthew Keller, did a series of studies asking this wonderful question: are the symptoms of depression the same no matter what brings it on? And he discovered that they're not. That depression is brought on by social issues and failures lead to feeling bad about yourself and guilty and a lot of other things. Failures in work environments and accomplishments more decrease your ability to accomplish what you want to accomplish. So
I would love to ask you about Jung and to get in whatever right. time you would like your thoughts on his primary
psychodynamics
ideas.
In general. Right.
Sure.
Okay. So, Dan, I'm so glad you asked about psychodynamics, because that's been a great frustration of mine, that evolutionary approaches haven't caught on. I was involved in beginnings of evolutionary psychology, and I wrote several articles back in the 1980s about an evolutionary approach to psychodynamics. And the question I asked was, is our capacity for keeping things unconscious an adaptation that's useful, or is it just that we can't get access to some things? And I came to the pretty strong conclusion that, you know, this specialized capacity for keeping things out of consciousness, sometimes even when we try really hard to remember things, really had all the hallmarks of something that was useful. And then I asked myself, well, how could it be useful? Bob Trivers, a very famous evolutionary psychology biologist, and Dick Alexander, an inspiration of mine at Michigan, they had gone on record and had lots of examples of people not being aware of their own mean and selfish impulses so they could better exploit other people without getting caught. I thought, well, is that true? And my experience with my patients and myself was that people were lying awake in bed at night wondering if they accidentally didn't smile at somebody on the street, you know? Mm-hmm. It was not like trying to trick people in more subtle ways. So I spent a couple of years on that with some colleagues, wrote some big articles, and concluded that actually Trivers and Alexander were partly right. Sometimes we stay unaware of selfish and mean impulses and pursue them without even really knowing it. But I also concluded that that capacity for not being aware of some things keeps us unaware of our friends' misdeeds. Mm-hmm. And when they're not completely loyal to us, it's much easier to have friends if you don't overinterpret every single thing everybody does as if it might be selfish or something. And I thought that was quite a good insight. I gave a talk for the American College of Psychoanalysis, or the American Psychoanalytic Society, about all this. And I was quite thrilled that they would finally have the scientific foundation that they've been long looking for. But it doesn't catch on. And I think there's an obvious reason in that once you take an evolutionary view, you have to start thinking even more deeply about how all of these capacities are useful. And so automatically assuming that, you know, trying to get to the unconscious root of things is going to be helpful is not wise. On the other hand, I'm not trying to say you shouldn't do that. It can be very helpful. And you mentioned Jung as well as Freud. There's a great opportunity left to be pursued there. Stevens and Price are two authors who wrote the book called Evolutionary Psychiatry way back when. It's a flawed book because their understanding of evolution was wrong. It's based on group selection, and it was an early effort. Some people go to it now and then think, oh, what a weird field. But no, they deserve credit for getting it going. There's a lot in there about how Jungian ideas of archetypes in particular might have evolved. And I think that's plausible. I mean, we have this image of a mother, and we have this image of a hero, and we have this image of, you know, a father. And you know, they're not exactly crisply defined anything, but these social roles have existed forever. And the idea that human minds have archetypes that we draw on to figure out who we might be dealing with, that's a very plausible idea, but it's never caught on. I think that the gulf between Jungian work and real basic fundamental evolutionary biology is pretty big. So I but this has all gotten me in trouble, Dan, because a number of people who said, why on earth do you have messed with those psychoanalysts? I said, well, because a lot of it's true. That's why. But you know, I don't think it's the most effective treatment for most things. It's, you know, deep psychoanalytic treatment, I think, is not, you know, plausible as a way of treating a lot of people. And it's not reliably effective for things like anxiety. Not nearly as effective as exposure therapy. On the other hand, early in my career, at least, I treated many people with such methods and sometimes got fabulous results. It's so hard to bring these different things together because we all mainly learn one way of approaching treatment. And most people start believing that whatever way they treat people corresponds to what causes things. So doctors who prescribe drugs a lot tend to believe that disorders come from brain abnormalities. People who do family therapy tend to believe that most problems come from family problems. People who do behavior therapy tend to believe that early experiences and learning tend to cause things. And I think it makes all of us very confused to realize, what if it's all true? What if everything can influence us? And there's top-down things like, you know, your thoughts influencing your brain and your hormones and your neurotransmitters, and vice versa. Your neurotransmitters and genes are influencing how you think. It's a tangle of web of causation. But I think an evolutionary framework helps us. Instead of trying to say, what's making this person sick? We need to do that also. We can ask, why is the whole system there in the first place? And how is this emotion normally regulated? And in this person, is it dysregulated, or is it normal but useless, or is it normal and useful? And now we can finally come to how all of this stuff is useful for patients. I bet you were going to go there soon. right. Yeah. So once I started talking to my patients about these perspectives, it just changed how many of them thought about themselves and their disorders. And I don't use the E word very often. I mean, a lot of people don't understand evolution. They're frightened of it, or their minister has told them that there's something bad about it or something. But you just start talking to people about, gosh, it sounds like what you're dealing with might have some meaning. Can we talk about, you know, what that anxiety might be arising from? And how it might be useful or not useful. And once people with panic disorder in particular realize that all those symptoms that they have are exactly the recipe for getting out of a life-threatening situation alive, then they say, oh my gosh, that makes perfect sense. And some of my patients, after understanding why those symptoms are there, they say, oh gosh, thank you, Dr. Nessie. I don't think I need you anymore. I just needed to understand what that was.
Fascinating.
It's even more so for depression, I think, because many people these days, I believe, are, you know, interpreting their own bad feelings as if there's something wrong with them in addition to feeling bad, that they have a disease. Some do have a disease, and many can benefit from treatment. But just as we treat people who have pain, even if the pain's from a broken leg or something, we should be trying to relieve the symptoms of people who have depression and anxiety and jealousy and boredom and excess romantic infatuation and all the other emotions we're prone to. Trying to understand those emotions in terms of normal things that can go awry, it's just so helpful to people to quit thinking of themselves as just defective beings. And I mean, my patients with social anxiety in particular, that's helpful. I mean, I'm a shy person. I've always been this way. I must be weak. You know, and once you talk with people like that and say, you know what, there's something much worse than having social phobia, and that is being completely oblivious to what other people think about you. And then they suddenly, oh, well, you know, there's actually some good to this too. It's not like it's all good, but it's really important for people to, you know, get away from thinking about themselves as just victims of some mindless problem, and to recognize that there may be meaning or may not be meaning in an emotion, and it's worth discussing.
One of my favorite essays of the last year or two was called "What Would a Hunter-Gatherer Do?" And it was basically going through a litany of various human ailments and addressing them from the perspective of what would a healthy hunter-gatherer do in that circumstance. And I'm so glad you brought up suggestions for how people can work through some of this. And I'd love to spend a little bit of time on that very theme, because I think you just mentioned the cognitive behavioral therapy or exposure therapy in general. There's a note that I had taken in doing research for the conversation where, in order to help people overcome anxiety, paradoxically, often one of the things that can be helpful is intentionally having them make mistakes. And you gave the example of walking into a McDonald's and asking to order a Whopper. I'd love to have you give some time, if you can, to suggestions that you might have for people who are struggling with maybe specifically depression and anxiety, and things that you've seen that can really help over the long term these people mitigate some of their suffering.
Gosh, Dan, I'm hesitant to do that. I have a big Twitter presence, and I see other people getting, you know, thousands of hits, and people following them because they give quick advice, you know, generalizations, and I just don't do that. Okay, a few generalizations. If you're in a really bad situation and you feel like you have to do something immediately, my best advice is wait.
Yeah.
I mean, most life problems are different. And I wish I could get that into the brains of every person who's thinking about suicide. Mm-hmm. Wait, you're going to think differently about this problem in a month or a year, and especially in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And likewise for people who say, they're fighting with their spouse and they think we have to end this right now. Wait, things are going to look different. Time is the great healer and allows things to settle down. But for anxiety, there's another generalization, and you've already put your finger on it. Every time you go away from something that you fear, the fear gets worse. And if you go towards it, the anxiety is going to get worse, which is why behavior therapy is so abnormal feeling to people. I have a spider phobia. You want me to reach out and touch a spider? And you have to spend a lot of time with people saying, well, here's how it works. The inner mind adjusts your level of anxiety based on its experience. And if you, in fact, allow your anxiety to become very, very high because you're right next to this spider, you're going to feel awful for a while. But after 40 minutes, most of the anxiety is going to be gone, and you're going to feel very confident, and you're going to lose much of your anxiety. And a lot of my early work was treating people with simple phobias, because we did work on neuroendocrine responses to anxiety. And it was so exciting and thrilling to see people who had not been able to go on a picnic with their child because they might see a worm on the sidewalk or a bird in the park. And they would come back after just 2 hours of treatment with a pet bird or with stories about going on a picnic with their child. And it really works to expose people. But you have to expose them to what it is they fear. And that you gave the example of going into McDonald's and asking for a Whopper. That's one of the actual exercises we had many of our patients do. And you know what happens if you do that. People say, oh, you mean a Big Mac? People are just not as critical as you think they are. But this brings us to, again, this business of trying to do it one at a time. I mean, some patients with social anxiety are very critical of other people. And every person around them they see as making mistakes, who deserve criticism, moral criticism, or some other criticism. And they kind of sensibly think that other people are being as critical of them as they are critical of other people. And it's a hard thing to get people to be less critical of other people. But that's the key for some of them. For other people, that's irrelevant. For other people, they're just very, very sensitive. And some people have had traumatic experiences. Kid who was told by the second grade teacher, you can hold it longer, and then lost bowel and bladder control in front of everybody. I mean, oh my God. And that it's not something you just put aside, you know?
Yeah. I want to read a few quotes and then end with arguably my favorite idea I came across in preparing for this conversation, because I know we're getting close to the end of our time together. These are a few quotes from you. And maybe I'll give some space after I'm done to have you add anything you'd like to any of the quotes. This is the first one. Quote, what gives us pleasure, this is such an important point, I think, what gives us pleasure is not actually accomplishing our goals. What gives us happiness is making progress towards our goals. This means you got to have a goal of some sort. This is the second one, quote, and you alluded to this earlier in the conversation, quote, like fever and pain, anxiety and low mood are useful, normal responses to some situations. And then the third is, quote, the German psychologist Judah Heckhausen, now in California, studied a group of childless middle-aged women who were still hoping to have a baby. As they approached menopause, their emotional distress became more and more intense. But after menopause, those who gave up their hope for pregnancy lost their depression symptoms. The irony is deep. Hope is often at the root of depression.
Now, that last little bit about hope being at the root of depression. Early in my career, I told all my patients, don't let the depression interfere with what you're trying to do. It's trying to stop you from doing things. Don't let it. It's abnormal. And then I got older, experienced my own failures, and gradually recognized that life was really, really hard for a lot of people. And most of us have to learn how to fail gracefully and decide when to do it in a thoughtful way. And that really changed my approach to things. And you mentioned very early in this podcast episode the necessity of trying to figure out when it's wise to give up on something and when it's wise to continue. But also the things you just mentioned, they're all based on real good research by psychologists. Judah Heckhausen is a very sophisticated psychological researcher, gathers lots of data. And the other work you talked about pursuing goals, is done by Carver and Shire, who are very wonderful motivational psychologists in Florida. And they've done lots of works with having people trace mazes and doing other kinds of things. And they've really shown, no, it's not reaching the goal that makes you happy for any length of time. It's pursuing a goal and making progress towards that goal. Being from Ann Arbor, I had the opportunity to meet a number of people who wanted to become poets. Now, if your goal in life is to become a poet and make a living at it, I have advice for you. Nobody makes a living as a poet. On the other hand, I met a number of people who really wanted to write poetry and share it with people, and they found ways of doing that. I found other people who were driving a taxi cab and losing their fiancé because the fiancé didn't want to, you know, marry somebody who was not going to be able to support them and the child and the family. And again, we get into the individuals, don't we, Dan? Every single time, it's trying to figure things out for individuals. But my point I'm trying to make now is, and we haven't mentioned the title of my book either, have we?
True. No, we haven't.
Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, and the subtitle about evolutionary psychiatry. But that's the theme we've been talking about, is there are good reasons for bad feelings, that good reasons for them to exist at all, which does not mean they're always useful. It doesn't mean that the mechanisms that come from are always normal. Sometimes they're not working right. But there are good reasons for bad feelings, and there's so much great research. I mean, I had a great time. I think there's 800 references at the end of the book, which shouldn't frighten people away, because those are in tiny print, and it's a readable book. But I was so impressed as I did the work to prepare for that book at how much wonderful research there is out there already on these topics that very few psychiatrists and psychotherapists are aware of. Some of it's done in cognitive psychology, some is in motivational psychology, some is in behavioral psychology, some of it's in genetics and neurochemistry. But trying to pull it all together, what evolutionary psychiatry really offers, and my whole career is really about evolutionary psychiatry, what it offers is a framework for making sense out of everything without having to lock yourself into believing that everything comes from genes or everything comes from childhood abuse or everything comes from thinking wrong about things or everything comes from bad experiences that you've learned, bad habits. It's a framework for putting it all together. And more psychiatrists and psychotherapists are, I think, recognizing that they really want a framework that allows them to be a complete therapist who's considering all possible causes and all possible treatments. And that's my real hope for this field, is that it continues to grow in a rigorous way and provide a framework for everybody who's in this business, both as treatment providers and as patients, to recognize that it's complicated, but there is a way of pulling it all together and trying to make sense out of mental disorders.
I love it. I think that's why I'm so interested in it too, is the framework that it provides. I want to close with arguably my favorite idea that I heard from you, and then I'd love to give you some closing time to speak about it. And this is related to the work of an insect biologist that I heard you speak about. I think her name is Mary Genuist Eberhard. And the idea is that, maybe I'll just put this to you. It's about partner choice and the cynicism that can often come from people who learn about the world of evolution and genes and adopt a selfish gene mentality. But I thought your argument about pushing back against that cynicism and selfishness and alluding to genuine altruism that nature seems to, in your mind, have given to humans. I'd love to maybe close on this because I think it's such an important point and one that I think I'll take away from this for quite a while.
So you know what? That's a whole other hour-long podcast for us sometime. But it connects. I think you had Richard Wrangham on recently.
I did. Yeah.
And you know, he and I were colleagues together. We started the Evolution of Human Behavior program at the University of Michigan, which really grew into evolutionary psychology. That's how it all got started. And we were both influenced a lot by Dick Alexander and others, who did take a view that all organisms are inevitably shaped to do what's in their genes' interests and they can't help it. And if you think you're generous and a good person, you're not. It's just you've been tricked. I found that just wrong in terms of, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, in terms of my own personal experience and my patient's experience. And I literally spent 10 years thinking about that. Doing a big book on evolution and the capacity of commitment, using game theory to see if I could understand it, and finally reading Mary Genuist Eberhard's work for the third time and recognizing that individuals who make self-interested choices of the best possible partner end up giving advantages to people who are desirable partners, because the best partners get the best partners. And they, among other things, they have more resources and more babies, not just, you know, sexual partners. These are partners in work and groups and all the rest. So I came up with, I've written 3 or 4 articles now about what I call social selection, which is Mary Jane West Eberhard's idea applied to humans. And I'm quite confident that this is the correct explanation for the origins of human goodness and our origins of our deep concern about what everybody thinks about us every minute. But as I just suggested, this is a topic for another conversation, another time. I think saying anything more about it now would not help to give the depths of that. But it is a real explanation for our human capacities for goodness. And it is a good antidote to what I consider to be a very harmful, superficial view of and selfish gene perspective, even as I'll completely defend the selfish gene perspective as correct for understanding organisms in general. Lots more there.
Maybe we can do that again at some point in the future. I would look forward to that. Randy, this has been such a pleasure. I really appreciate your work and the time you gave to me and the show today. It was wonderful to meet you.
Thanks so much. Anybody who's interested can go to Google and find all kinds of things for free on my website.
Perfect. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.